Hello, book lovers! I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Today, we have a different kind of show. It's our holiday recommendation show, where I ask guests to recommend books by emerging authors they've loved this year. We are looking for books that maybe flew under the radar, that we didn't catch, that you didn't catch, but we should all read. Joining me today are Disha Filia and Gwydion Sullivan. Disha Filia's debut short story collection, The Secret Life of Church Ladies, won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, the Story Prize, the LA Times Book Prize, among many, many other accolades. Gwydion Sullivan is a cultural critic, essayist, and playwright, and he serves as the executive director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Both of them are going to pull back the curtain a bit on the whole prize world and how it works and give us their recommendations, because if you want to know who's reading tons of books, it's these guys. Welcome to the show, Disha and Gwydion.
Thanks for having us, Rachel.
Hey, Rachel. Thank you for having me.
So we are going to dive right in. Disha, I see on your list you have a book by Andy Davis called Let Me Liberate You. How did I miss this book? Tell me about it.
It was actually 2024, and I have been shouting from the rooftops for the last year and this year about this book, because it is just laugh out loud funny. It's timely. We have this artist who's not quite sure she's really as good as people think. Maybe it's the hype, and she's in New York, and she leaves and goes back to her native Barbados, where she kind of just sort of inadvertently starts a class war. And
what? Just like inadvertently starts a class war. Just throw that in.
Inadvertently starts a class war. And there were so many twists. And I remember thinking, this is so immersive. You know, the way she just embeds you in the culture and the individual lives of not only the main character, Saber, but her aunt, and all of this sort of wild cast of characters. And there's also a podcast on there, too, that features prominently. So there's, you know, it's very of the moment.
It sounds like it. Disha, this book sounds amazing. But I have to admit, like, people say all the time, this book is funny. You're going to laugh out loud. Like, were you actually laughing?
I was laughing so much, I was self-conscious of it. I would be alone and I'm like, what is wrong with me? That kind of like snickering sort of thing. And there's also stuff that you're laughing when you shouldn't be laughing. Like, it's very irreverent. I couldn't believe it was a debut.
Wow.
It hit all the marks. You know, it was incredibly well written, excellent, just masterful storytelling, and really good humor, which is hard to do.
Yeah, it's very hard. And on a more serious side, it seems like it addresses this idea of a savior complex.
Yes.
So I wasn't clear, like, is it critiquing it? Is it just pointing it out? Like, what's it doing about this savior complex?
So Saber, basically, even though she's from Barbados, she's an outsider, you know, because she's left. And then also her family is upper class. And so she just decides that she's going to speak out and take a stand on behalf of the domestic workers in the country. Nobody asked her to do that. And the results aren't as simple as she imagines them to be. And so she gets herself in a bit of a cluster.
Yeah. And family dynamics play a big part too, right?
Oh, gosh. So many family secrets. There's mother-daughter drama, which is my wheelhouse. There are illicit affairs. There's a lot of lying. There's a lot of subterfuge. People use the word propulsive a lot for a book. It is truly, it just never stopped moving, but in a good way. You know, I didn't feel exhausted by it. And it wasn't like slapstick or anything like that, just super smart humor.
So we're talking about Andy Davis's Let Me Liberate You. So where should you read it? Is this like a beach book? Is this like, you know, what's the best place to be reading it?
Oh, I would read this on like a cross-country flight, because you're not going to want to stop. to eat, drink, nothing. Just when you have a ton of time on your hands and you can just get lost in it.
Even though you're going to be laughing out loud.
Yes, that's the other thing. Just prepare to be embarrassed. I have no shame. I will laugh out loud. Because you know what? It's advertising. When you laugh out loud at books and somebody's looking, you know, cutting their eyes at you, you just hold up the book and like, get this, and you can laugh too and not be so grumpy. So
that's Disha Filia, and she is suggesting, recommending that we all read Andy Davis's debut novel, Let Me Liberate You. Gwydion Sullivan, we are going to move on to you. You have on your list this book, The Correspondent by Virginia Evans. And this book, I have to admit that it hit my desk and it's an epistolary novel. And I was just like, I don't know. I don't read them. And since then, I feel like everyone and their mother has been recommending this book to me. Tell us about this novel.
It's easy to dismiss an epistolary novel because we've all read them, but this is a contemporary epistolary novel. It's not just letters, it's emails, and they're all sent either to or by the main character, Sybil Van Antwerp. She's sort of in the twilight of her life, and it's like her soul is undergoing this slow thaw. She's this former high-profile lawyer, and she's having to reckon with some of her past professional choices, which may not have been the most ethical. And she's a divorcee and her ex-husband is dying and she's trying to find the right words to say goodbye to him. And she's a mother and she can't quite say the things she needs to say to her estranged daughter. And she's being courted by two different men and she thought she'd been done with romance. And she's trying to learn in her older adult life how to articulate her feelings and set boundaries and doing things she never had to do before. And in all of these conversations, it's this slow build toward one really difficult, really painful letter that she has to write. It's all about forgiveness and trying to achieve redemption. And it's just gorgeous.
So we're talking about The Correspondent by Virginia Evans. I've also had people like rave, fall over themselves talking about how good the audiobook is.
Oh my gosh. Yes, this audiobook. I listened to the audio version and I highly recommend it. She's in these extended back and forths with so many people, including, you know, a thug that she wants prosecuted who's threatening her, who she slowly befriends. And a software support call center employee who she also becomes genuine friend with. And then the narration relies on different voices for every character. And it really, really, really brings them all to life. It makes you feel like you get to eavesdrop on one intimate conversation after another, being let in where you don't normally get let in. And it's captivating.
Yeah, you know, people sometimes get embarrassed and they're like, oh, an audiobook isn't really reading. It is reading. It is reading.
It's 100% reading. An audiobook is reading. It is. The words are getting inside your head one way or another.
Yes, I can't stand those debates where people say that it's not reading or it doesn't count or all of those things. And I just think that people who believe that are thieves of joy.
Well said.
I will say that I listened to this audiobook on the treadmill at the gym and while lifting weights at the gym, and I was overcome with emotion in several moments. So Disha may have reminded us that it's okay to laugh in public. It's also okay to cry, let me tell you.
I just, you know, I'm a sucker for books that play with form. So you had me at epistolary. I'm going to add this to my TBR. Thank you.
You know, I actually saw the Wall Street Journal just did an article on the author here. We're talking about The Correspondent by Virginia Evans. And she was so honest, talking about how she's tried to publish like 7 books or something before this one and all the hundreds, thousands of rejections she's gotten before this masterpiece came out.
That's this business.
I'm glad she stuck with it because without it, we wouldn't have a correspondent to read.
Yeah.
Rachel, it's got to be your turn. What do you got to tell us about?
You know, I have a huge pile of books here, my recommendations, right? Because I read a lot of books, as you guys know. And so I actually want to highlight some books by smaller publishers and the stories that we're not really hearing about. And the first one that I want to talk about, it's a romance. It's called My Holidate. It's by Lauren Blakely. And she self-published this. So I actually read this on Kindle Unlimited like a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. And it's since been picked up. And it's part of this trend of lots and lots of authors who start out self-publishing and they're on Kindle Unlimited. And so you can read the book for free. If you subscribe, you pay, I forget what it is, $10 a month. You get an unlimited number of books. And there are lots of romance authors doing that and they get 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 reviews. And then suddenly they're picked up by a major publisher. So The Holidate, my favorite Holidate, is coming out with a major publisher. And I got this copy. It landed on my porch and I was shocked and so thrilled for her. It's super fun. It has all the fun tropes: fake dating, billionaire romance, single dad, one bed, small town, second chances, right? For those of you who love the tropes, they're all in there. But I also just want to bring it up because these novels are super fun and they're starting a new trend in publishing that I think we should be paying attention to.
I got sort of an education in romance, indie romance, and all of those tropes when I joined Threads. I don't know what algorithm put me where I am, but I'm primarily in the indie author, romance author world. So I learned all about this trend that you're talking about and the different tropes. You know, I'm familiar with romance as a genre, but those very specific tropes. And it's really, really fun, as you said, and interesting. And the writers are so passionate, and to see the reader support that they have and the huge fan base and the fandoms, you know, that they, you know, really go for these authors. And it's amazing and just really wonderful to see them getting the attention and the support and the success that they deserve.
Disha, I love that you're bringing that up because one of the reasons why I love these books are afterwards just the fan discussions about them, right? It is so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
Can I put in another plug for Literary Threads? Literary Threads is thrilling. Disha and I follow each other and there are so many other voices out there and you feel like you're being let into the party.
Yes.
I just want to mention really quickly, there are two other authors that have been picked up who are self-published that I was a fan of before, and they're now been picked up by major publishers who are also coming out with books this holiday season. We have Becca Mack, the fifth book in her series, a hockey romance series, which if you haven't read hockey romance, start with Becca Mack. It's so good. And her book, Breathe With Me, just came out, and I think it actually debuted on the New York Times bestseller list.
Like, great.
Wow. Welcome to publishing. Unbelievable. I mean, when I read her books, they had the typos, they had, right, all the love, all the fun. Wow. And also Ellie Wilde's If Only You Knew. So that's the third and final book in the Oakwood Bay series. Again, just these are super fun. And I don't want people to be embarrassed about talking about these kinds of books from these indie publishers because there's so much energy and fun in these books. We should talk about them.
Absolutely. I mean, it almost feels like scandalous to say books should be entertaining. Not every book doesn't have to be, I'll rephrase that. Books can be entertaining, and it's okay if you read for entertainment. There's this really false dichotomy that if something is like serious or literary, it can't also entertain, that it must bore us to death. And I reject that. Absolutely.
Oh, and we absolutely have to stop policing what counts as reading or what counts as quality for people.
Yes.
Reading is reading. It's all wonderful. We should celebrate every time anyone picks up any book.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. We are in the middle of our holiday recommendations show, and I have special guests Disha Filia and Gwydion Sullivan here to talk to us and offer some recommendations. And these are special guests because we here at Check This Out are partnered with the Penn Faulkner Foundation, and Gwydion is the executive director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Disha Filia has won the Penn Faulkner Award, among many other awards, for her incredible short stories, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. And I just want to take a few minutes and talk to you guys about the whole prize world in the literary community, because we've been talking about the fun indie books, right, and what's out there. Those books never win awards. And we see lots of attention going to the books that are on awards lists. So how do you get on a list? Maybe, Gwydion, could you give us just a quick overview, like, how many books do you get a year? Like, what does that look like to get to a prize winner?
In an average year, we get between 400 and 450 submissions for the Penn Faulkner Award, which is a lot. We have three judges who read them all and get us down to a long list of 10. Then from there, they do the really hard work, in, to my mind, of narrowing from 10 to 5 finalists, all of whom receive awards from the Penn Faulkner Foundation. And then they have to choose. We call them a winner, but we also say first among equals, to really emphasize that we're celebrating all 5 of our finalist books. And that's the joy. That's the process.
So 1 out of 450 books is the winner.
1 out of 400 to 450 books every year.
And that is not, of course, not the number that are published every year. That's the number that even just makes it to you. So that's a huge, wow, huge funnel. And Disha, you've been a judge for this. So from your perspective, right, did you read 400 books? Like, how does that all work behind the scenes?
Teamwork. There are 3 of us. And if you're lucky, as I was, to work with 2 judges, Luis Lurea and Bruce Holzinger, you bond. You become like family, because it is daunting. And we all love books, and we all are trying to be good literary citizens. And we know the significance of this prize, and really want to be thoughtful in our assessment and our judging. And so the way it started for us, it was like, okay, we're never going to narrow this down, because we like everything, and we, you know, we would have these incredible, I mean, that's the thing, when you get people who love books and you hand us, you know, over 400 books, we're going to revel in that. But then there's the work. There is the work of getting it down to 10 and then 5 and then 1. And so I think part of the way that it works well is just having judges that you're with, that you can be really candid with and just exchange ideas and just think, you know, what are we rewarding, and what does it mean to be excellent, and really being expansive around that idea of excellence. And you have 3 very different readers, you know, we're very different people, different readers, different writers. So logistically, though, there's no way we could all read all of those books in their entirety. So we each get batches as they are coming in, and we read for a really long period of time. And, you know, we have to give every book a fair shot and read a portion of it before we move on. But we see and have access to all of the books. So if a book's not on my list, but I see it on someone else's list, and I'm like, oh, I've heard about that one, or I read it on my own, and, you know, we want to talk about it. And so just the congeniality of the process and the integrity and the honesty. I had a great experience, toughest job, but Bruce and Luis made it absolutely wonderful. And then you're so excited for the writers, the long list writers, the short list writers. It is truly a celebration of great writing and great writers.
So Gwydion, you're not actually a judge. You oversee the foundation and the, you know, judge process, I guess. But you don't actually have anything to do with choosing these books. But do either of you hear or have any, I don't know, like, I'm wondering, are there things that, quick flags that will be like, oh yeah, this book is like definitely staying in this pile, or I don't know about this book. Like, is there anything?
I want to say it's very important that I don't have any say. We choose the judges choose the winners. And our judges do an amazing job. What's really unique about the Penn Faulkner Award is that it is the only major literary prize, as far as we know, that's judged entirely by writers. That's what makes it unique in the field. It's writers saying, look here, world, this is where the real stuff is happening. And that's really important. There are no critics, there's no publishers, there's no booksellers, there's no one who isn't an accomplished professional who is wading through those 400 novels to find our long list.
I would say that that's the beauty of having three judges, because my taste is different from Luis's, is different from Bruce's. And so, you know, someone might like novels that are slow starts and quieter novels, we might say. And then someone else might be like, this has got to catch me in the first 50 pages or I'm out, you know, sort of thing. And so when you bring together that diversity, then all kinds of books get a shot. So we each have our own tastes. We each have our own biases. For example, I love, and we'll talk more about this in the recommendations, I love voicey books where the characters are just like the voice of the narrator, even if it's third person, is just so strong from the outset. I am a sucker for books like that. I'm also a sucker for books about grief. Like, just make me laugh, make me cry. But grief is, those are my sweet spots. So we all bring those things to bear in terms of what resonates with us.
I mean, so it seems like you guys do a ton of work, don't get me wrong, but there's also a little bit of luck to it, which I've heard other authors mention, right? Like, do you have readers on this panel that, you know, someone that's going to fall for this book? It's the same thing when you're applying for residencies or different awards, right? That you could submit the same book 10 times and be rejected 9 of them. Doesn't mean it's a bad book.
Exactly. And that's what I wish more writers understood, and to Gwydion's point earlier, and just stick with it, because there's all of this is subjective. And there are so many incredible books that don't win prizes. Like, I can't emphasize that enough, that that's a prize is not, as much as we value the prize, it's not what validates you. It's not what makes you a real writer. It doesn't mean that if you didn't get one, your book isn't great. Because it is tough. There are, you know, only so many prizes. And it is, who's judging this year? Who are the other books that yours is competing with? All of these things that are outside of your control as a writer.
Yeah, I love that, because, it's hard when you're out there writing and, you know, not everyone's going to love your book. You're going to get rejected a lot. And just like Virginia Evans from The Correspondent, right? You just have to keep going.
Not winning a prize is not a rejection. I tell young writers this all the time. You have to enjoy the journey of writing. You can't be focused on the destination.
And that's why it's so important to write, because you love it. Because that's, if the writing, if the completion of something, if storytelling is the thing that makes you feel good and feel successful, then you don't, you know, the extrinsic things that you can't control don't matter as much. So you have to want to do it for other reasons.
Very true. Speaking of subjective opinions, Disha, let's talk about another book on your recommendations list. Another book that somehow just didn't make my top pile. This must happen to judges too, but I would love to hear about This Thing of Ours by Frederick Joseph. There are a lot of parts of it that just sounded amazing. So tell me about this book.
So first about Fred. He is a dynamo. He is one of those, like, I guess, triple, maybe even quadruple threat poet, prose writer, YA. What can't Fred do? I was introduced to his work, his nonfiction. He wrote another book that was so slept on called Patriarchy Blues. And I feel like every person in this country should read it, but especially every man in this country should read it. And it's a man writing about patriarchy. So that's what introduced me. That book introduced me to Fred as a writer. And so his most recent book is a YA novel, very timely, about a 17-year-old athlete who has this, you know, promising future in basketball, but then has an injury that sidelines him. And a teacher reaches out. He's Black, and this Black teacher who reaches out and encourages him to join a writing program. And he's now introduced to this whole other world in literature by marginalized authors, and he makes new friends. And then, of course, there's got to be a spoiler. Some students at his school create an anti-woke video. This is the, you know, era that we're living in, that goes viral. and it threatens the teacher's job, that writing program, and even the other students' safety. And so this is a novel that deals beautifully without being didactic or heavy-handed or losing the artistry with topics like book banning and discrimination, and also how we view our student athletes and their, you know, their worthiness and those sorts of things. And so Fred can do in nonfiction and fiction, he can really speak to the questions of the moment in a very, very powerful way, and just brings us into this the world of the student athlete, but without the character is so dynamic that, you know, you can't help but you know, root for him and for his peers.
I mean, you had me at student athlete. I love books about student athletes.
Yes, yes. This Thing of Ours by Fred Joseph.
Sounds like a book I should add to my own reading list.
Yes. And we don't have enough, I think, YA novels, at least I haven't seen them, about the experience of student athletes. So again, shout out to Fred for bringing this topic, you know, to the forefront. And again, doing it in a way that it's not about, it's really still really good storytelling and not just didactism.
I mean, I love, it seems like he's really captured this this notion that there is a bravery involved with being a student athlete that I think is often overlooked, right? It's a hard thing to get up on a basketball court in this case, or a track, or whatever your sport may be, a baseball field, softball field, right? You're on stage, and that becomes your personality in so many ways. And then if you're injured, what do you become? What happens? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is a really big moment in a teen's life. And he seems to really address that in a way that is resonating with teens and adults.
Oh, absolutely. It's a best-selling book. And I'm just really so proud of Fred because he really speaks truth to power in his books. And you know, he has his audience. And I believe people feel seen by his work.
This Thing of Ours by Frederick Joseph. All right, he's got two more readers at least. Gwydion and I are both nodding, saying, yes, I'm getting that book. I actually also want to briefly mention another sort of YA book, although I'm not sure that it is YA, but it's a sort of romance-ish fantasy book called Oathbound by Tracy Dion. This is the third book.
Yes.
Yes, you know this book.
I know it because of Threads. I haven't read it yet, but because of Threads.
So you need to read the trilogy. So the last one just came out. Again, we're talking about Oathbound by Tracy Dion. This is the third book in the Legendborn cycle. And these are really contemporary fantasies that blend what she calls Southern Black Girl magic with secret societies and the legend of King Arthur. And I guess because the main character, Bree, is 17, 18, these books are sort of pushed down to YA. And adults aren't picking them up. But I just cannot stress enough, like, pick up this series. Oathbound is the third, right? It is all available, the Legendborn cycle. It is so good. I mean, I'd never even heard of Southern Black Girl magic as right, a trope before. And now, like, Tracy Dion has brought this to life for me.
And see, I see it as an adult book because it was adults readers who brought it to my attention first. So that's, again, one of those, I think, artificial boundaries around who reads what and, you know, and what counts and so forth. But yes, kudos to Tracy.
Any book an adult reads is an adult book, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, so we're talking about This Thing of Ours by Frederick Joseph, and we're talking about Oathbound by Tracy Dion, both books that we have loved that are, you know, often called YA or young readers, but actually, as Gwydion is pointing out, lots of adults are reading. Let's call them adult novels. Gwydion, let's go to you and talk about a novel called Controlled Conversations by Carl Legodsky.
This was a finalist for this year's Penn Hemingway Award, and if I tell you that this is a spy novel, which it absolutely is, you're probably going to immediately think about shadowy figures and tailing suspects and caches of money and shootouts, and all of those elements are there. But there is so much more to this novel that really made it stand out for me, that really elevated it. It's set in Soviet-controlled Poland in 1982. So, spoiler, the specter of an authoritarian government hangs over the whole story, which may or may not seem relevant right now in America. The main character, although this is sort of an ensemble novel where you really get into the minds of a lot of people living under authoritarianism, the main character is really a young woman named Amelia. She operates a telephone switchboard with the plugs into the holes, and her job is literally to listen in on people talking to each other and report them to party officials if they say anything that might seem revolutionary, which is the source of the title. She is controlling conversations. Every time she plugs in the switchboard, she has to say, "This conversation is being controlled," so that they know they're being listened in on. Where the book gets really compelling is when she falls in love with her best friend, Kalina, who happens to be a member of the resistance. So you've got these two women on either side of the political chasm that they're living under, and they're trying to figure out how to be in love, forgetting for the fact that that also makes it a queer novel in 1982 Russia. And the two of them with their friend, Agata, they have to make these increasingly desperate and difficult choices to try and stay true to themselves and stay alive and not be unalived by the authoritarian government. And to go back to the word Disha used earlier, propulsive, this is a propulsive story. It absolutely carries you forward to an immense climax that I won't spoil, but suffice it to say, you'll be reading on the edge of your seat until the very last page.
We're talking about Controlled Conversations by Karel Logodsky. So there's sort of this double entendre then, right? The book is called Controlled Conversations because the main character, Amelia, is controlling the conversation or listening in, but also the characters themselves seem to be self-censoring, right? They're sort of trying to control themselves. That seems like a big part of the book.
There's also the self-censoring about whether you really want to admit that you're in love, whether you really are willing to go out on a limb and tell your friend you love them. There's all kinds of self-censoring that's happening in this novel. It is a central theme to the book.
How is the Penn Hemingway different from the Penn Faulkner?
The Penn Hemingway Award, which we at Penn Faulkner have actually just taken over the administration of, goes to a debut novel. So whereas the Penn Faulkner Award is open to novels and short story collections, and they don't have to be debuts.
Okay, so as I was listening to Gwydion talk about Controlled Conversations, I was like, who can I get that for the holidays? It sounds like a great like holiday read. What do you have some holiday reads that you're thinking about giving as gifts, Rachel?
Yes, Disha, thank you for asking. Of course I do. many more books in my pile over here. So I want to talk next about a book called The Master Jeweler, and it's by Wayna Dye Randall. This book, it's historical fiction. It's about a 15-year-old orphan in 1925 Harbin, so we're in China, and the orphan stumbles on a priceless Fabergé egg. What I really love about it is we see Shanghai in the 20s and 30s, the glitzy glamour, female ambition, but we also see war looming and the underworld. And we really get into the craftsmanship of jewelry and diamonds. And I actually used to work in the diamond industry for 2 years. And so I was all in, like soldering stones, jewelry. Like it was just such a fun book.
Jewelry is a male-dominated world. Is this about a woman living in that male world?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Gwydion. At this time in the 20s especially, men were really in control. And here we have a woman trying to break in. So that female ambition was something that was really fun to see. You know, she's very gritty. It's about survival and chosen family. And it was just, you know, it was a really interesting read on a time and an era and a place that I just don't know anything about, which is why I read.
It's why any of us read, really, to some extent, to get to interrogate your own human soul on the one hand and to understand what we don't already know in this world.
Yeah.
And who would you say would love this book?
So I would say anybody who really wants to read about jewelry, right, the master jeweler, but also if you want to see about pre-war 1920s China, mm-hmm. And, you know, what it takes to survive there and make it in the world as a kid, as a girl, right, with no family. If you're into historical fiction, this is definitely your read. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. We are talking to Gwydion Sullivan today and Disha Filia, and we are talking all about holiday recommendations. Disha, let's talk about your next recommendation, Fish Tales by Nnedi Jones. Tell us about this book.
So this book itself has a great story in that it was published in 1984. And the editor was none other than Toni Morrison. And even for its time, this book was like a jaw dropper. The main character is a woman, she's a Black woman named Lewis, but race is never mentioned in this book. But it's like Black people know that these are Black people. Don't ask me how I know. And it's funny, it's irreverent, and it's unapologetically weird and gross and carnal. There's sex, there's drugs, there's psych ward visits. It's super queer. It's like a fever dream. Lewis moves back and forth between Detroit and New York City with this wild cast of characters, including her ex-husband, who's a doctor who pays for all of her shenanigans. And then she has a friend who's a hustler, who's a gay hustler, and she's always somewhere with him and they're always having sex with somebody new. And then, you know, she'll take a little trip to the psych ward and then she comes back. And then she's also looking for love, sort of, kind of, amidst all the drugs. And the author, Nnedi Jones, says that this book is autobiographical, which is wild. And she is now 84 years old, I believe. And this book got a resurgence. A culture journalist named Michael Gonzalez was writing about her book. He does a lot of unsung Black literary hero work. And his articles and some others got the publisher to republish Fish Tales this year. And so I started seeing it on Instagram. So I was like, I got to check this book out. And it's, again, one of those where I'm just snickering because it's set in the 70s, by the way. So that makes it even all the more like we know what the 70s were like. Nnedi Jones takes you right back to those moments of just complete abandon.
You had me at unapologetically weird.
Yes.
What's crazy is to think that the 70s are now historical fiction, too.
Right, right. And I also love that Toni Morrison edited this book because we think we kind of put her in a certain kind of box. But we know then that she fought for this book. She advocated for this book. And Nnedi Jones was adamant that it not be in back in the 80s, that it not be promoted as a Black book. She is like, it is a book. She didn't want it to be called. They were like, we're going to market it like the Black Naked Lunch. And she's like, it is not the Naked Lunch. It is Fish Tales. So she's a character. So after reading the book, I just kept reading articles and their new interviews with her now. And she, when you read about her as an 80-year-old, you're like, yep, this is the woman that wrote this book and that lived this life. You know, so much of this is from her own life, which the fact that she survived and lived to tell the tale is amazing.
And also the whole, the interest, the story around this story has been so interesting, right? When I've seen it, you know, when I saw it published, republished and coming out and everyone's like, Toni Morrison, like, yes. That's amazing. But also that this book is resonating today.
Yes.
In a way that somehow it didn't, because it seems to me that when it first came out, it was sort of a very quiet book.
Yes.
It was not a quiet book, but it was quietly received or not, you know, mm-hmm. It just didn't sell that many copies. And now it's selling.
Yeah. And I think part of it is that whole, you know, it was the era, of Black books. And, you know, we had to be a bit more buttoned up. And this book is not as the opposite of buttoned up. And also that whole marketing thing. You know, we know so much about this industry is in terms of how books are marketed. And because they couldn't call it the Black Naked Lunch, they didn't know what to do with it. And this was not, you know, Terry McMillan. This was not, you know, Alice Walker. And so Nettie Jones was just fresh and a singular and one of one. And marketing doesn't always know what to do with people who are not on trend, you know? And now she's back. And I love that.
Marketing is concerned with selling books, not with, ideally, as it should be, connecting the right people with the right books they ought to find.
You know, I've had this conversation with a number of authors on this show around how do you market a book? And, you know, we already talked about, is this YA or is this adult, right? Is this Black fiction or is it just fiction, right? Is this women's fiction or just fiction? This comes up a lot. And it really is a problem because you have to go to a certain aisle in a bookstore, right? Or you have to be in a certain section. So where are you going to be? And these labels are just, I think, taking away readers, but I don't have a solution to that. Do you?
Yeah. I mean, I think if when she said, or when anyone says, like, I don't want it, my book to be called, say, Black fiction or whatever, the fear is that the message that's sent is only Black people can read this book, which is, of course, not true. I don't have a problem with someone calling my book a Black book, because what I understand is in the Black experience, which is vast, there's the whole human experience, right? So I might be writing specifically about Southern Black women, or as you said earlier, Southern Black girl magic, but there are entry points, access points for people who are not Southern, who are not Black, who are not women. You know, we all have mothers. We all have dealt with, you know, some sort of dogma or some sort of stigma or grief, all of those things that are universal. And so we can write these very specific cultural stories and still be accessible to everyone. But marketing doesn't always see it that way. It's like, what box can we put you in?
Yeah. But now that we're talking about, we just touched on motherhood, I want to bring up another book that's on my list. It's called I Wanted to Be Wonderful by Leahy Lapid, because this is being marketed also, I think, as a, you know, a book about mothering or mothers. But again, I just want to call it fiction, right? Because you don't have to be a mother to appreciate this book. And this is really, it follows the lives of two women in their first years of marriage and motherhood. And it's basically how it's like not happily ever after, right? It's about the real things that happen and what it's actually really like to be married, to have kids, right? It's not this happy-go-lucky, like everything is perfect from here on out. It's actually the grit. And I think she actually goes into that really well in I Wanted to Be Wonderful by Leahy Lapid.
This is Gwydion Theta, a dual narrative book?
Yes, it is. So actually, there are two narrators, and you have one is trying to live the happily ever after, and the other woman is actually inspired by the author herself. And that one seemed more real to me. But so it's sort of like the dream of what it should be like, and then it's like the reality of what it was. And I thought that the dual narrative in this book really worked. Dual narratives can be hard because you have to have such distinct voices and opinions. And I think that Leahy Lapid did it really well in this book, I Wanted to Be Wonderful. Disha, let's go to you. Let's talk about a short story collection that you want to recommend. It's called Bitter Over Sweet by Melissa Lanes Brownlee. Tell us about Bitter Over Sweet.
So for the last few years, I've had the honor of judging the Santa Fe Writers Project Book Prize. And Melissa's manuscript was among those that I was reading. And when I got to it, I was like, this is it. This is the winner. I did read the others. I always read them all, but I just knew. It is very, people would call it experimental, but I don't think that's the right word for this collection. It is small vignettes of flash fiction about, most of them are about a girl named Tita who lives in Hawaii, but sometimes the girls and women are Tita, and sometimes they're her sister, and sometimes they're her aunt, or sometimes they're her mother. But the point is that this is about life in Hawaii for girls and women. And this is one of those books that I mentioned earlier that I like that are voicey, like the voice just leaps off of the page. There's a lot of pop culture in this book. That's something else I'm a sucker for. And it brings to mind, if you're familiar with the short story Girl by Jamaica Kincaid, which is set in Barbados and the narrator is going back and forth. It's a grandmother and a granddaughter, and through the domestic tasks that they're doing, the grandmother is teaching the granddaughter about how to be a woman. But it's this very sort of patriarchal, misogynistic, slut-shamey kind of lessons, but through the course of just domestic work. And so that same energy shows up in Bitter Over Sweet, where the girls and the women in this book, the home is the site of some unfortunate lessons and revelations for them. There's this intergenerational tug of war. There's violence. And it's all in the backdrop of they're in Hawaii, which those of us who don't live there think of as paradise. And it's like, no, this is what life is really like here for people who live here. And then the encroaching gentrification and destruction of the island itself is sort of parallel with the ways that women and girls' lives are encroached upon. But there is still a lot of power there, a lot of imagination, a lot of grit, and just incredibly beautiful language and a lot of heart.
And so Hawaii itself is a character in this book.
Yes, yes. Sometimes at odds with Tita and the other girls and women, and then sometimes it's at odds with the larger forces at play.
And so this is a short story collection, Bitter Over Sweet by Melissa Lanes Brownlee. Is there one story that stood out to you in particular?
Oh my gosh, there's one where the grandmother is having the grandchildren sort through the flour and the meal to take out the bugs, that the this food that they get from the government. And the one who finds the most bugs gets honey. And actually, no, that's Bitter Over Sweet. That's the title story. But there's so much, like, you know, so much that's revealed about what's in store for these children and what they're already grappling with in this story that on the page, it's, you know, maybe 12 lines. And the economy that Melissa works in, just sort of these very, very tight stories, they just pack such a punch.
Wow, I can't imagine a 12-line story.
Yes, and she can do it. She really, really does it. And the range. So we have these very domestic stories. And then there's a recurring character, the boy from Kona, who's an astronaut. And it's based on the fact that when the Challenger exploded, one of the astronauts that was on it and died was a Hawaiian astronaut. And so he is evoked, and his memory and his family and his people are mentioned in a few of the stories as well, because Tita is gets to wear an astronaut suit. And so she's thinking about him and she's dreaming about her own future.
Wow. We're talking about a short story collection, Bitter Over Sweet by Melissa Lanes Brownlee.
Rachel, I still see a big pile of books behind you. Can you give us a summary of what else you got?
Yes, we are having so much fun that we are actually running out of time. But I do thank you for asking, Gwydion, because there are two books that I want to make sure that I mention before we hop off. The first is Swallowtail by Emily Ross. She's a thriller writer. And this is a mystery for people who love mysteries with all the tropes. There's past trauma returns, serial killer on the loose, small town with hidden secrets, dual timeline, plus art. This book is really, really fun. We have a veteran detective Samantha Starr, and Greek mythology. So this is actually a book coming out. It's the, I think, second book being published by Galliote Press, which is a new, again, indie press. And you can see one of the themes here. I'm highlighting indies because, again, there are some amazing books that are coming out from indies and they're being self-published that are, you know, not necessarily getting the amazing Penn Faulkner or Penn Hemingway, but we should still be reading or looking to. And then lastly, before we wrap up, I want to talk about a book by a local, Before I Forget, by Tori Henwood Hone. This book is about a daughter who is returning home at the age of 26 when her father is diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And her dad is losing the past, but he's predicting the future. So it's kind of funny. It's like a, you know, quarter life moment as these kinds of books are being talked about, but also really sharp observations about modern life and wellness culture, you know, sort of tongue in cheek, like, you know, what is wellness? Is it, you know, just a way to market and make more money, or does it actually mean something? So all of that wraps up with family dynamics, forgiveness, and growth. And I just thought that Tori did an amazing job here on her debut novel, Before I Forget, by Tori Henwood Hone. Disha and Gwydion, thank you so much for joining me today here on the Recommendations Show.
This was fun, Rachel. Thanks for having us.
Rachel, I'm so glad to get to talk to you.
Everybody have an amazing holiday season and read, 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 read on. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels Abandon the Stars and Atomic Anna. You have been listening to Check This Out. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission, is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books that we've talked about here today and this season. Thanks so much for listening. Read on.